Beth Barrett and her late husband, Dan, combined their love of theater and music history to explore the story of early entertainment in Colorado, culminating in their book, High Drama, Colorado's Historic Theaters. And if you haven't had a chance to read it, it is a fantastic read. Beth has been a librarian for over 30 years, and she currently serves as Director of Library Services at the Louisville, Colorado Public Library. Her program today is entitled From Prize Fights to Shakespeare, Traveling Entertainers in the Pikes Peak Region. Please help me welcome Beth Barrett.
Hello. I must tell you, it's a hard thing to follow Nikola Tesla on the podium. But I am here today to talk with you about some of what my husband and I gleaned as we did research in Colorado's historic theaters for about 10 years. And of course, I'd like to focus today on the Colorado Springs area. And what we found is that even from its early days, Colorado and Colorado Springs had theater. Most of it was related to mining. A lot of what I have to say is going to just fit right in with what other speakers have said earlier in the day, starting with the gold strikes and later the silver strikes in the 1850s to 1880s. Streams of people came into this area. And so while we had the settlers here, it really was the railroads that brought civilization. Performers who had heretofore been pretty much limited to a small geographic area because if they wanted to travel, they had to use a wagon. They had to travel on some of those roads we've seen pictures of. Traveling was hard. All of a sudden, we had railroads that were linking small communities in ways that had not been previously possible. So therefore, performers could hop on a train, they could take their entire cast, they could take their crew, they could take sets, design, costumes, and go from place to place and find these audiences that were just starved for entertainment. There. This is an example. This is Anna Held, for those of you who are interested in early or turn of the 20th century theater. Anna Held was a popular stage performer. She was married to Florence Ziegfeld, the impresario. And she's the lady in the white blouse. She's traveling here through the Rockies with her company. So this was a very typical shot of what traveling performers did. And really, no one in this area in Colorado was more influential in the development of Colorado's traveling entertainment than Peter McCourt. Now, some of you may know that Peter McCourt was the brother of Elizabeth McCourt, who is better known probably to all of you as Baby Doe Tabor. Peter started out as Haw Tabor's personal secretary. And shortly thereafter, he became the theater manager for the luxurious Tabor Grand Opera House in Denver. So as he was trying to encourage book people on the East Coast to come to the Tabor Grand Opera House, he realized he would have a lot more success if he'd be able to say, and not only can you play Denver, but you can play lots of other theaters and make it worth your while. So he began to develop a rudimentary theater booking system. And eventually he had theaters and little towns throughout Colorado, into Utah, Wyoming, and New Mexico. And that was just called the Silver Circuit. He was really the right person at the right time. Between 1870 and 1880, 40,000 miles of railroad track were added in the U.S. It really did revolutionize everything. And it certainly, for traveling, well, it created traveling performers because suddenly it was profitable to make these coast-to-coast trips. So besides Anna Held, who came? An entire range from the very most famous and revered actors of the day. Edwin Booth and Lawrence Barrett were renowned tragedians, and they came to Colorado on more than one occasion. Once they even came together, and they kept almost all the receipts. It was really hard for a theater to make money with those two in town. But they were popular. Sometimes actors that were a little past their prime, but who still had great name recognition. Maybe it's sort of like celebrities now that are on game shows. I don't know. You know, they're not acting anymore, but they're on game shows. But they could capitalize on their names and go to these places that were still delighted to see them close out their careers. Plays that were melodramas were very popular, so we had whole companies that would do melodramas, and those usually dealt with some sort of a social issue. We look at them today and think they're kind of funny, but they were very popular at the time. The most performed play, and we're talking about the time roughly from 1880 to about 1910, 1912, and probably 1920. But especially in the last decades of the 19th century, the most popular play was Uncle Tom's Cabin. And there were, it was so popular that there were entire shows that did nothing but Uncle Tom's Cabin. They started in Philadelphia and they went straight across the country and did nothing but perform Uncle Tom's Cabin. And they were just collectively referred to as Tom shows because there were so many of them. Colorado Springs could expect to have at least one Tom show come through every year. There were other kinds of entertainment and certainly good music. John Philip Sousa, for example, came at the turn of the century every year, came to Colorado. There were light opera companies, there were grand opera companies, there were a number of companies that performed Gilbert and Sullivan's very popular operettas. Interestingly, many of them were pirated versions. Copyright law wasn't quite what it is today. So you'd have somebody in London who'd sit in the dark and scribble down all the lines and then quickly get those over to this side of the pond and put together a company and go on the road with the latest Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. There were other entertainers that also came. There were magicians, circus performers, social critics, lecturers, prize fighters, you name it. They pretty much all came, and most of them came to Colorado. Colorado Springs, of course, was called Little London from very early in its history, so it had cultural aspirations from the very beginning. Within its first decade, it had a number of theaters, probably the best of which was called City Hall Theater, although that really wasn't saying much. It had a very small stage. It was about 10 by 20. And the backstage area was so cramped that only one person at a time could change costume or put on makeup. So just to give you a flavor of what some of those performances were like, in 1878, George Rignold came with his entire Grand Opera House troupe to perform at the City Hall Theater, and he did Shakespeare's Henry V. Somehow or other, they got a horse to the second story. I don't know how they got him down. But in any case, at one point, Henry was dismissing some French emissaries, and he said, "Begone," and under his breath he said, "But I don't know where the devil you'll go to." And in the last act, he was exhorting his troops into battle, and he had a royal flagstaff in his hand, and he thrust it forward, and it stuck in the ceiling and and didn't come out. So Colorado Springs obviously needed something a little better than that. And three prominent bankers here in the Springs stepped forward and built this building, which is the Colorado Springs Opera House. It opened just 3 years after that interesting performance of Henry V in 1881. It was a lovely theater. It seated 800, which was four times what City Hall Theater did. It had a lot of gilt and brocade. It was a lovely place. If you wanted a seat on the main floor, it was $1.50. If you couldn't afford $1.50, you could sit in the second balcony, which was called the Garden of the Gods, and you could get a seat for about 50 cents. I want to say a word about the fact that it was called an opera house. The word theater had a really negative connotation to many people in the late 19th century. saloons had theaters, lots of places had theaters, and they were considered havens of vice. So if you wanted to designate what was the place where the best theater that a community had to offer would be located in, you'd call it an opera house, because opera and Shakespeare were beyond reproach. Most people knew, however, you probably wouldn't have very much opera. That's what the interior of the opera house looked like. Had very fancy opera house chairs, and the curtain was of a Venetian scene. I don't know why it was Venice, but it was. And on the top, it had the Colorado state motto, Nil sine numine, which meant nothing without providence. Marshall Sprague, who was a chronicler of early Colorado Springs, claimed that one of the owners said it meant no sign of a new mine. The theater was opened in April of 1881 by Maud Granger. She was a very popular actress of the day. She came with her entire company, and she chose to play Camille. This was an unfortunate choice. Camille tells the very sad story of a young Parisian courtesan who dies of tuberculosis at the end of the opera. And even in 1880, Colorado Springs was touting itself as the sanatorium of the world. It just wasn't the best choice. But actually, everybody came, all of society came. It was very popular, well received. But it did fall down a little bit, and I apologize for that play on words. At the final curtain, this is how the Gazette reported it. The couch upon which the actress was to make her ascent into the starry region happened to be poorly constructed, while the actress was rather portly. So, when breathing her last breaths of this sordid existence, Camille saw visions of a new world, and the cot gave way, and instead of finding herself housed securely in another sphere, the actress found herself in an ungraceful position on the floor. The climax was capped, however, when Miss Granger, not knowing that the curtain had been raised for her to answer a call, uttered forth a volley of abuse upon the stage manager in the hearing of the entire audience in terms not at all conducive to her good reputation. The stage manager Miss Granger was taking to task was probably Simeon Nash Nye, and I'll talk about him a little later. He considered from that moment onward that Camille was an unlucky play, and I have to say, although it was performed many times in Colorado Springs, more often than not, he was right. He was right. Anyway, a year after the opening, Oscar Wilde, the British aesthete and playwright, appeared on the Springs, on the stage of the Colorado Springs Opera House. He lectured on art decoration, and the audience, we're told, was subdued. I don't think they quite knew what to make of each other, and which actually got to be even more of an issue when Wilde left Colorado Springs and went into the mountains. He had a very robust response from the miners in Leadville when he went there. Because they really didn't understand each other and sort of carried on a conversation back and forth while he was on stage. But they had a dinner for him at the bottom of the Matchless Mine after he was, after his lecture was finished. And the miners finally decided they were really impressed with him because he held his liquor so well. So Wilde wrote about it in his memoirs, and he said, "The amazement of the miners when they saw that art and appetite could go hand in hand knew no bounds. The first course was whiskey. The second course was whiskey. The third course was whiskey. All the courses were whiskey, and still they called it supper." This is a picture of the interior of the Colorado Springs Opera House. You can see it was very ornate, had this lovely horseshoe balcony supported by these pillars. We're going to come back to the pillars in a little bit. It was a very popular house, had lots of sellouts. I mentioned Simeon Nash Nye, who was the stage manager and then later the theater manager. He held that position for 33 years. And really, he was the person who was most influential in getting performers booked into the opera house. He brought Sarah Bernhardt here, for example. I must say that she also played Camille. by that time, businesses in the area presented her with an alternate ending. They proposed that maybe Camille would live instead of dying of tuberculosis since she was in Colorado Springs. And it just infuriated Sarah Bernhardt. She tore up the script and she threw it back at Simeon Nashnai. He was right. It really was not a popular choice. It wasn't a good choice. He also was responsible for bringing in a soprano from Italy, Dora De Filippi, and she was the person Puccini chose to sing Madame Butterfly. She initiated the role and came here and sang it. It was really remarkable. Not only did he get these kinds of entertainers, but he also booked vaudeville troupes and a number of different kinds of performers. Hardly ever put his foot wrong. He was good at matching up the audience to the performers. I wanted to show you a little bit about this theater, too. This is the most lavish theater that Colorado Springs ever had. It's the Burns Theater, which opened in 1912. Mr. Burns was a one-time plumber who made his fortune in Cripple Creek and gold. And when he was turned down, he wanted to book the Colorado Springs Opera House for a social event. He wasn't really deemed to be quite that upper crust. And he decided to build his own theater. And this is it. He really outdid the Opera House. He spent $350,000 to build this, which was four times what the Opera House had cost. It seated 1,400, which was almost double what the Opera House did. And it had a stage that was large enough to accommodate anything. Huge stage. This is a picture of it under construction because it was interesting. Unlike almost all other theaters of the time, it had cantilevered balconies that hung out over the main floor, so that you didn't get that unfortunate seat that was behind the pillar like the Colorado Springs Opera House had. Townspeople weren't terribly convinced it was safe, and so in this picture you can see Mr. Burns had 100-pound sacks of sand put in every one of the seats. That's what you can see, those little lumps, so that he could prove to townspeople that the theater was actually safe. The Burns gave Colorado Springs Society a new house with great sight lines and terrific acoustics. Over the years, a lot of notables came. Helen Keller was here, Sergei Rachmaninoff, Ignaz Paderewski. George M. Cohan came with his musical 45 Minutes from Broadway. He was here for a week, and 10,000 people came to the theater to see it. This is just a little detail of what that terracotta exterior looked like. But to sort of wrap up, because Denver could draw big names, and with the advent of this silver circuit with railroads, Colorado Springs residents really did get to see some of the best entertainment the entire country had to offer. Managers, for the most part, avoided things in Colorado Springs that were considered risque, which was unlike many other towns in the state. And Colorado Springs audiences were known for expecting the very best, and they were also known for arriving late. A typical review in 1922, covering an appearance by Ethel Barrymore, stated, "Possibly Miss Barrymore has found audiences colder than that at the Burns last evening, but surely not often. Late as usual in arriving, people settled down, finally with the attitude, 'Well, we're ready, go ahead and amuse us if you can.'" Over time, traveling companies found it difficult to compete with motion pictures. And even here in the Springs, by 1912, the time when the Burns opened, there were four motion picture houses in Colorado Springs. And eventually both the Opera House and the Burns installed motion picture equipment, and they would alternate. So you might have six nights of vaudeville and one night of a motion picture. And gradually over time, it switched until finally they were doing maybe six nights of motion pictures and one night of live theater. Finally, the Burns was sold to a motion picture franchise that required that there be no live theater. So that was in 1928. It continued on as a movie theater for another 45 years. Probably many of you in the audience remember it as The Chief. Neither the Opera House nor the Burns survive as theaters anymore. But we do have one last remnant here of this age in the city, and that's the mighty Wurlitzer organ that now is housed in the city auditorium. That was originally installed in the Burns Theater. It had 500 pipes. It's just magnificent. When the Burns was torn down, it was moved to the city auditorium, and so there are now weekly concerts. You can go and hear it. And it's just, it's such a nice reminder of the theatrical history of Colorado Springs. You can kind of imagine that time when traveling theater was on the wane and motion pictures were in the ascendancy. You can sit there and watch one of those silent movies. Mm-hmm. So I urge you to, if you haven't gone, go see it or hear it. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Beth. Colorado Springs audience still expect the very best, and you delivered it. Thank you. I'm pleased to announce our next presenter is Amy Ziegler, who is the archivist for the Special Collections Department at the Pikes Peak Library District. Amy came to Colorado Springs from Austin, Texas, where she received her master's in information science from the University of Texas at Austin, and we're so happy to have her here. Amy also holds a BA degree from Oklahoma State University in history. Prior to coming to Colorado Springs, she worked at the Center for American History in Austin, Texas, as project archivist for the Professional Touring Entertainment Collection. Her program is entitled Mining for Interest in the First National Bank of Cripple Creek Collection. Please welcome Amy.
Well, good afternoon. As an archivist in Special Collections, I have had the privilege to work on the First National Bank of Cripple Creek Collection. Now, I know what you're thinking, though, bank records. That doesn't sound like an interesting collection to work on, but I'm hopeful that by the end of this presentation, you'll be a little more intrigued by some of the information that's in the collection and some of the fantastic primary resources. So just to let you know where we're headed this afternoon, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the collection itself, also about one of the major creators of the records, A.E. Carlton, and then just to give you a few examples of some of the topics that you can find in the collection, such as the Colorado Labor Wars, the Cripple Creek Drainage Tunnel, and then some business practices of the bank. But this is by no means an all-inclusive list of the topics that you can find in this collection. And then we'll follow up with some research possibilities in the archives. So just a little bit about the collection. It's pretty huge. It's 87 cubic feet. Now I have an example for you guys. So 1 cubic feet is this box full of things. So if you imagine 87 boxes full, that's how big the collection is. And some of the records are in very poor condition. They were covered with soot. Some had water damage. Some had actually been in a fire, so there were singed edges on the papers. And they date back pretty early, back to 1893 and go all the way to 1966. But you won't really find a lot of information in the 60s. Primarily, the focus is going to be on the early 1900s. And the format is entirely paper-based. It's primarily correspondence, so 87 boxes of just letters after letters after letters. There's not even any photographs, which is kind of a shame. And you'll also, whenever I started going through the records, I noticed that they were pretty much divided between the records of the bank and the records of the president. And when I first surveyed it, you know, it really just seemed like really routine financial documentation, transactions, things that just seemed like regular routine business things. But when I started getting to the president's records, that's when things started getting interesting. And pretty soon I was running around the office saying, you won't believe what I just found. So just a little bit about the major creator of the records, A.E. Carlton. He was the president of the bank. And he actually grew up in Warren, Illinois. He was born in February 1866. And he attended Beloit College in Wisconsin. After graduation, he opened a merchandising store in Warren. However, he got sick. He got tuberculosis. And like so many other people, he came to Colorado Springs for treatment. But then he started to get better. So his brother Leslie and Carlton, they moved up to Cripple Creek and they started the Colorado Trading and Transfer Company. And this was only the beginning of some of his business ventures. He was a very prominent businessman. He was president of several companies, including the City Bank of Victor, the First National Bank of Canyon City, Dr. Jackpot Mining Company, Holly Sugar Company, and the list goes on and on. But he also had a little bit of an intriguing romantic life going on. While he was in Warren, Illinois, he secretly married a woman, and nobody in Cripple Creek knew that. But while he was in Cripple Creek, he also happened to acquire two fiancées. So needless to say, the divorce proceedings were quite scandalous in Cripple Creek and made a fantastic two-page news story in the Gazette. So here you had a man who was very prominent in business. He knew he had an intriguing personal life. And pretty soon we're going to see that he was also involved in some pretty big political issues at the time. So you know his papers are going to be good. So when we look at the Colorado labor wars, this was an issue that he was really involved in. And what the Colorado labor wars was a series of strikes between labor and capital, where the unions were led by the Western Federation of Labor, and the capitalists were following the Cripple Creek Mine Owners Association and the Citizens Alliance, of which Carlton supported the latter. And the strikes actually got so violent, so intense, that Governor James Peabody called in the militia to stop the strikes. Now the mine owners not only supported this, the militia coming in, they not only supported it ideologically, but they were also supporting it financially. So when we start looking at the records, we see that Carlton was not only a member of the Mine Owners Association, he was also on the Finance Committee. So he was really involved in trying to raise funds to keep the militia there. You'll find letters of personal contributions, him trying to seek people from out of state. And one of the major supporters were coming from letters from mine owners who were contributing a percentage of their payroll, approximately 10%. And did they ever need the money? There's a letter that states they owed $500 just in milk for the militia in town. And in one instance, Carlton had estimated that the mine owners had contributed $250,000 in addition to the $395,000+ that they'd already spent from the state. Now in this letter, I think this is a really great illustration of how Carlton was keeping track of his finances. And you'll see there's kind of three sections here to this letter. In the very first one, you see the people that have agreed to pay and they've already paid Carlton. And the largest contributors are the banks. They paid $10,000. So Bank of Victor, Exchange National Bank of Colorado Springs. When we look at the second section, these are the people that have agreed to pay, but they just haven't paid him yet. So he's got him written down for what they owe him. But I think what's interesting is this third section here, where it's the people that have not agreed to pay, but Carlton just thinks they need to pay. And I love that he even has the amounts listed for what they need to pay. But you know, they weren't only spending money on the militia, they were also spending money on detective agencies. They were keeping tabs on the unions, keeping tabs on individuals, providing reports. You'll find letters actually from the Dewar's Detective Agency from St. Louis, Missouri, where they were saying, you know, we can help you out. And in one letter they say, I saw by the papers that you were the owner of the Findlay Mines, which was blown up and killed a lot of men. I wish to state I can find who done the job and who the guilty parties are and guarantee to get the necessary facts. My rates are reasonable and service the best. Carlton wrote back, at the present time, we have very efficient men looking after Cripple Creek matters. Who were these very efficient men? They were none other than the Pinkerton Detective Agency. So you'll find letters of them. There's reports on union activity, also that they had and put people in the Western Federation of Labor so that they could keep tabs on what people were doing. But it wasn't only the detective agencies that were keeping tabs on people. It was also the local law enforcement. In this letter from Sheriff Ed Bell, he came into office after the forceful resignation of Sheriff Robertson in Cripple Creek, and Carlton had helped to get Sheriff Ed Bell into this position. Now, if we look at the third paragraph down right here, it states that Dave Reed, engineer on the Delmonico, was heard by Old Man Gray and E.C. Moffitt, both of Independence, talking against Alliance, Mine Owners Association, and justified blowing up the men on the Findlay Mine. Now, in a later letter, the undersheriff replies and states, you know, we've already heard about this man, don't worry about it, we've already arrested him. Then if we look at the very first paragraph, we see it states that Robert and Ed Green, contractors on the Magnolia, located right on the edge of town, are reported to be very bad men. I suggest they be taken up before the deportation committee. So here we have this fantastic primary source document about the possibility of people actually being deported, possibly to Denver, Kansas, New Mexico. Now here is just an example of, now I know I told you that there weren't any photographs in the collection. However, if you look in the photo archives and special collections, we have this wonderful photograph album of deported miners. So you can see how you could use one collection in conjunction with another and how that can really enhance your research. And now we're going to switch gears a little bit to one of Carleton's business ventures. This was the Cripple Creek Drainage Tunnel. And the problem came from the fact that there was all of this gold underneath the mines, but it was covered up by water, so they couldn't have access to it. So they built a drainage tunnel, they were able to drain the water, have access to the gold, which worked out fine. However, we'll find in the collection lots of information about the working conditions in the mine. You'll find things from the Bureau of Mines about safety recommendations. Not only were they going out saying what needed to be fixed, but they were also doing follow-up saying, you know, you didn't fix that until an accident had occurred. And you'll actually find accident reports in the collection. This one was actually from a Theo Fosberg, who was superintendent on the tunnel for a month. However, a rail had punctured his leg and scraped the bone down 4 inches. And you'll also find other accident reports where people have actually died. But one of the fascinating things that I think about the accident reports is that it was actually filled out by the cashier of the bank. And so how involved were, you know, the employees of the bank actually working with Carleton? So in this letter, we have a little more insight into their relationship. And what makes this letter really unique, it's a cashier has written to Carleton, that's the typed writing, but then the handwritten writing is Carleton's writing. And that's also unique because you very rarely see Carleton's handwriting, his signature, so that also makes this letter somewhat more unique. But he's just responded to his concerns throughout the letter. And in one instance, the cashier is really upset that a Mr. Burris from the El Paso mine in Cripple Creek, he's depositing way more money with the bank in Colorado Springs than he is in Cripple Creek. So Carleton's advice is, pat him on the back. Don't dwell too much on our rights, but peddle hot air. Tell him you want to make a good showing while I am away. Another thing you'll find are codes in the bank. And these are really, you'll find these a lot in the telegrams, which would make sense because you're a businessman. You don't want other people to intercept your communication. But what's really great about the collection is you'll find the keys associated with the codes. So you're able to translate and figure out what's actually going on. And in this one, it's really just the vice president's writing to Carleton, and he's asking if he would endorse a $50,000 loan. But also as a side note, I think it's interesting to note that we have a code book from Spencer Penrose in Special Collections as well. Now, the codes don't match up, which, I mean, I'm sure that's very helpful for the businessmen of the time, but also a unique aspect of a collection. But now, what happened if you were at the bank and you wanted to get a loan? Of course, these were the days before there were FICO scores and credit checks, so people were writing the bank and they were asking about the individual, and a lot of times you'll just get really basic biographical information, the person, their occupation, are they married, things like that. But sometimes it gets a little more small town gossipy. So I like to call them character summations of people. And in this example here we have, they tell me Lynn Richmond is drinking pretty hard. I was wondering if we shouldn't cut down on his line of credit. I would like to help Lynn, but if he buys bootleg, he will surely go broke. And also political ties, those could also come into play to influence people's credit. You'll see people that, you know, if they supported the unions, if they didn't, how that would influence their credit line as well. But now if you got a loan from Carleton, you really wanted to pay him on time. As we saw that there were the detective agencies helping him out with the labor wars, checking in on people, they were also being used as bill collectors. And in one example, we have a collector, his name is Emil Selbach in Salt Lake City, Utah. And he's writing to a Frank French. And he's really wanting to get, that's the one that he needs the money from, is from the Frank French. So in a letter dated January 25th, 1910, he writes and says, "I do not intend to let Frank play horse with me. He may commit perjury when he is fighting with his wife, but I am through with him and want my matters settled up as agreed." Okay, so not even a month later, Carlton has completely lost his patience with him, and he replies back and says, "I thought you were a real collector. What about the French notes? Shall I send one of my high binders out there with chloroform and a gun?" So I think you should probably pay him on time. But you'll also find that the detective agencies were also going out and investigating forgeries. And we have these fantastic reports in the collections. They read just like a spy novel. They're incredibly detailed, and they're narrowing down the suspects as they, you know, they find the forgery, and they do. And they're just really great reports that you can find in the collection. So, but this is not, of course, all of the topics that you can find in this collection. Down here in the lower right, I have an example of a petition to make Cripple Creek anti-saloon territory. I find that interesting that it's in the collection. So, you know, there's a lot of other things you could do with this. You can even use it for genealogical research. I mean, there's tons of other banking history, other things that you could do with it. We also have several other archival collections, which you can view on the Rocky Mountain Online Archives on the Special Collections website. And also you can use in conjunction with your research other sources we have in Special Collections that aren't in the archives, like the Colorado Springs Gazette, our genealogy department, the maps, and the local history books. But there are a few thoughts to consider when you're doing archives research. Don't judge a collection by its name. You know, when I first started working on this collection, I thought, it's not really going to be a lot in here. But as I went through it, you know, I really was surprised at all the different types of information that I could find. So, use other collections in the archives to supplement your research. As we did with the photo collection, there's also other resources you could do, but also visit other archival repositories. By doing that, you can find resources that will strengthen your argument. They'll also oppose your argument. It makes your research a lot more in depth. But it's going to take time. You know, the letters in the archives, they're not individually cataloged. It's not the way archives are set up. So it will take you a little bit of time to get through your research. But that's kind of the fun part, because you'll go off onto other topics. Sometimes you'll find more questions than you will answers. And that's really the intriguing part about it. So if you're ever downtown, feel free, stop by, come see me. We're open 7 days a week, free parking on Sundays. And I hope that I have somewhat changed your opinion about an unassuming collection. So thank you for your time.